ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. The United States is getting ready to lift its year-long ban on cattle imports from Mexico. Why is the gate reopening? And what could it mean for Aussie beef exports? We'll talk about this soon. Also this afternoon, before 1:30, we meet some of the people keeping the art of stock whip making alive.
I think it's more important than ever because it builds character, it builds patience and unreal craft. Like, you know, if these kids are building a whip, they've got something to show for all their time and effort. And I think that's important.
We've got a cracking good show today. I hope you can stick around. A reminder, though, if you do need to duck out into the paddock or maybe the reception's a bit lousy where you are in the territory, you can always download the podcast and listen at a time that suits you. We're going to start today's program with some big water news. Consolidated Pastoral Company, CPC, has been granted 4 water extraction licenses in the Northern Territory, which, when you add them all up, total more than 15,500 megalitres per year. So the water licenses are for CPC's cropping plans on Newcastle Waters and the neighbouring Tenandidgee and Powell Creek stations in the Barkly, and also further north at Dungowan Station on the Buchanan Highway in the Victoria River District. I spoke to CPC's Chief Executive Troy Setter earlier on and started by asking him about the stations in the Barkly and what the plan is for all of this water.
The plan is to use that water where we've already developed land for cropping. So we've been cropping on those stations for a couple of years now, mainly sorghum for cattle feed and some legumes, hay, and then also we've done a little bit of cotton when the market was right. So that's the plan is to develop some of that farming land for irrigation, because at the moment it's all been dry land.
Right, so you're being sort of growing crops during the wet season. This gives you a chance to top them up at the back end of the wet and grow stuff during the dry season as well.
Yeah, absolutely, and gives us the opportunity to have more consistent cropping and more consistent production, which will flow to, you know, to higher productivity and ultimately more consistency for employment of employees, but also for contractors.
What crops are working best in the Barkly at the moment?
Forage sorghum and sorghum for silage is working the best. Grain is okay. We've had 2 record years of flooding the last 2 years, and that's made some challenges with waterlogging. And then, you know, prior to that, we had some pretty dry years as well. I think it'll also allow us to look at things that can be grown during the dry season that are better suited to the cooler soil temperatures. We've certainly had trouble with things like soybeans with hot soil temperatures. If we could grow them when it's a bit cooler, I think that would be beneficial.
I see in the applications it talks about using this water to grow, sorghum, rose grass, cavalcade, cotton, oats. If another crop pops up as being a real winner commercially, do you have to go back to the government, back to the department and reapply, or if all of a sudden there's big money in rock melons, you can go for it?
I think it depends on the crop. If it's a crop that fits into the traditional pastoral use and aligns with our application, no, we don't. But if we if it's something that's outside of that, we would need to.
Right. So if it was rock melons, horticulture, you would need to.
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
If it's a non-pastoral crop, we would need to. Is my understanding. But we'd absolutely, other people looking to do these sorts of things should get their own advice, just to be clear.
Understood. And Dungowan, is it very, like, there's 4,738 megalitres a year for Dungowan now. So, you know, that's irrigation coming into the VRD. Are you sort of doing similar things up there?
Yeah, we plan to. I think VRD will be more livestock grazing. We started working with the NT government several years ago with thinking that it would be a combination of potentially leucina with grass. At the moment, that site's got a pasture mix in it, just as we settle the soils down.
And my understanding is a lot of these licences are staged, as in you can't go and put 7,000 megs a year on 10 digi-station from day one. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, the process is a staged development for sustainable development, but also I think we're realists that there's not the infrastructure in the Northern Territory for developing irrigation systems en masse, so it'll take us time. So we've agreed and we proposed and agreed with the NT government to stagger those developments as we think they'll practically occur. Also, to development of irrigation or anything in the Northern Territory is very expensive, and we want to do it carefully and make sure that we've do it in a sustainable way.
Will CPC have to prove certain, I guess, environmental milestones along the way to get to the next stage?
There is environmental compliance that we need to meet for anything we do on the stations, and it falls part of that process. We will be monitoring water levels and pumping levels as we develop, as others have been doing that have been developing in this region, in the NT.
How far down do you need to drill to get water, say in the Barkly?
Good question. We've done plenty of test drilling, and so you have 100 to 200 metres at this stage. Okay. But we'll need to do more on that.
So if all goes to plan for CPC, when would you love to have some pivots up and running and growing crops for you?
Look, ideally, next year or the year after, it'd be great to see it happening.
And a lot of the water allocation plans that this all relies on, a lot of them are ending up in the courtrooms. Are you expecting delays?
We hope not. We've gone through quite a rigorous community consultation process and engagement with neighbours and other stakeholders. There was a public process available for people to contribute and comment. We've responded to those. We then worked through quite a long technical process with the Northern Territory Government and their experts, and we used a variety of specialty consultants to ensure that what we were proposing was sustainable and met the license requirements. So we hope that there isn't a legal challenge to this development, because one, we believe it's sustainable, but two, there's a material positive impacts for the Northern Territory for jobs and income for the territory.
All these crops to potentially be grown on these CPC properties, will it all be destined for the throats of CPC cattle, or will you have surplus for the industry?
We currently sell hay and some grain, and we've sold the cotton off our stations, so as well as supplied our own livestock. So we would see that we will continue to do both.
On cotton, have you got a dollars per bale figure in your mind on when it would be worth doing cotton in the Barkly?
Look, it really needs a 7 in front of it.
Yep.
And at the moment we're in the sixes, but I think that's predominantly been driven by the rapid increase in input costs, as fertilizer, chemical, seed, and fuel, labour costs have all gone up dramatically in the last 2 to 3 years. So to economically grow cotton, we would need a higher sale price. There's also some risk of flooding and waterlogging in the Barkly, and also the temperature and of the soil at establishment time can be pretty tricky. Yeah. But longer term, I think the Barkly will get there, and cotton will be part of a cropping rotation for Central Australia and Northern Australia.
Thanks so much for your time on the Country Hour today. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much, mate.
That's Troy Satter. He's the Chief Executive of the Consolidated Pastoral Company, which on Friday just gone was granted 4 water extraction licences in the Northern Territory. When you add them all up, they total more than 15,500 megalitres per year. So just to break that down for you, the 4 licences. There's one for Powell Creek Station, that's 480 megalitres a year. Dungowan Station in the VRD, that water licence is for 4,738 megalitres a year. Newcastle Waters, 3,060 megs a year. And Tenandidgee, that's a big water licence there, that's 7,290 megalitres per year. As mentioned there by Troy Setter, it will be a staged approach. Now, the Country Hour understands that this now makes CPC the second biggest groundwater licence holder in the Northern Territory behind Power and Water, noting that the big water licence for Singleton Station is currently invalid after that recent High Court ruling. So CPC, one of the Territory's biggest cattle companies, on track to potentially be the NT's biggest irrigator. Our text number at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. Got a message here from Marg who says, Matt, can you give us an idea what body of water that amount would equal? It may help us lay people to understand the amounts that these ag companies are consuming. I'll try my best here, Marg. So the 2 big licences in the Barkly for Newcastle Waters and Tenandidgee, which total sort of over 10,000 megs, I've got here from the department that the Georgina Basin, which that water's coming from, has got an estimated storage of 660 million megalitres. And the estimated sustainable yield for that basin is a bit over 186,000 megs per year, is what the government has decided what could sustainably be extracted each year. And there are currently 6 groundwater licences in that basin at the moment, taking sort of 2,000 megs. And when you now add the Newcastle Waters and Tenandidgee licences, that's going to increase it to about 8.5% of the total volume that's been allocated to agriculture. So big numbers, but all of them combined still 8.5% of the total volume. So a lot of water still left in that estimated sustainable yield, according to the NT government. All of this information now up on the Department of Environment and Water Resources website, if you're keen.
G'day, I'm Gavin Howie from Turf NT out at Middle Point. Welcome to the Country Hour.
The Northern Territory and federal governments have been clashing heads on how to power data centres, but they might be able to reach an agreement on water. The water ministers from every state and territory met with the federal minister, Murray Watt, on Friday, where he put forward a proposed national water use standard for data centres. Queensland said no. Queensland rejected the plan. And the Northern Territory hasn't agreed yet, but Murray Watt says an agreement should be reached with the Territory government soon.
The Northern Territory said that they weren't in a position to agree today, but we've been having some very constructive conversations, and I'm confident we can get there with them. It was unfortunate that Queensland was the only state or territory that refused to agree to national standards to manage the water use of data centres. I think that's a really big mistake for Queenslanders, and I think it's a big mistake for the country as a whole. But I'm really pleased that aside from Queensland and yet to confirm with the Northern Territory, other states and territories territories, including Tasmania, being a Liberal Party state, have agreed to minimum standards for data centres and their water use. We recognise that data centres have a lot of advantages for Australia. There's a lot of economic opportunities and other opportunities as well, but we do need to manage the risks regarding data centres, particularly when it comes to water usage, because if we don't, that means the risk is that they will use large quantities of water that households need, that farmers need, that industry needs, and they, of course, risk also putting up water prices, which no one wants to see happen either. This, by and large, has the support of the data centre industry. They want to see strong standards. They want to see national standards. I think people in the data centre industry know that there is already community disquiet about data centre development, and they know it's in their interest to be able to demonstrate that they've got high standards when it comes to water use, just as they do want to have high standards when it comes to energy use as well.
That's the Federal Water Minister, Murray Watt. The Northern Territory's Water Resources Minister, Joshua Burgoyne, says he's keen to work with the Commonwealth.
Every time ministers get together, data centres are a top priority and a top topic at the moment. I do just want to state that so far I've been working very collaboratively with the Water Minister, Minister Watt, and really appreciate the fact that he's called me about three times in the last couple of days to really get a gauge of where the Northern Territory's at and how we can work together so that it isn't the federal government coming in over the top of the Northern Territory. It's working collaboratively to ensure that we are managing this really important resource for those who live in the NT. Obviously, when we look at some of the states down south, a lot of the data centres are connecting directly into whether it be New South Wales or Victoria's drinking water, and that's straight into what's commonly known as potable water. Here in the Northern Territory, any data centre that's set up would probably be dropping its own bore and actually utilising its own infrastructure as it relates to water. So that's really a big difference up here. We have a very strong regulatory system whereby there are water plans that manage how much water can actually be used for industry or data centres and how much water is reserved for consumption by the community, for human consumption and drinking water. So I think what I really tried to and got across today to Minister Watt was that we have extremely strong regulatory processes in place in the Northern Territory that mean we are well positioned to welcome in data centres wherever they may end up. And really, we look at them more as just another form of industry. There won't be special water made available for data centres. They will have to comply with the water plans wherever they set up and will have to be licensed for a volume of water like any other user. We just want them to comply with the current regulation that we have in the Northern Territory, which has been managing water for some 70 years.
That is the Northern Territory's Minister for Water Resources, Joshua Burgoyne. It's 13 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. The United States is getting ready to open up the gate to cattle imports from Mexico again. This ban has been in place for a year, but the gates are opening. What could this mean for the Aussie cattle industry? We'll talk about this next.
G'day, my name is Amanda Murphy and I'm the President of the Northern Territory ICPA and you're listening to the Country Hour.
The United States has been Australia's biggest customer for beef this year. Exports are up 18% compared to this time in 2025. But the value of the beef is on the slide, with exported lean beef prices down by about 13% since April. And next week, the US is going to lift its year-long ban on Mexican cattle imports. Ripley Atkinson is from StoneX. He has just spent the last couple of weeks over in the US. Ripley, what would be your take on what the US market is doing at the moment?
Yeah, so from a cattle price perspective, the markets have experienced significant levels of volatility recently, and they have just eased off their highs set earlier this year as they come into or are experiencing summer. On the beef side, market values have also eased following really that key holiday period in May, June, leading up to Independence Day in early July, and beef and box beef prices, that is, for the US markets also just softened a touch. Generally, though, if you look at the market, both on the beef and cattle side, relative to longer-term performance, still in very, very strong shape, right up there with from a historical level, you know, really high levels.
Yeah, the beef import price for 90 CL still over 10 Aussie dollars a kilo, which historically is big.
Yeah, it is, exactly. And I think that little bit of perspective needs to be acknowledged. You know, yes, imported 90s and imported trim product from Australia and whatnot has eased recently, really, for the last few months. But if we look at it compared to longer-term historical levels, I'm talking 5 and 10 years, it's right up there at decile 9 levels. You know, so the market is still performing very strong, and what's underpinning that ultimately is this really sustained demand and strength from the consumer chasing beef and wanting beef in their shopping baskets or on the table in food service and quick service retail. So that demand there from the US marketplace and the consumer remains quite sound.
What is the latest on the US herd rebuild? It's been a bit of a tough question for a few years now. What have you seen and heard?
Yeah, it's always the first thing on everyone's lips, I think, to understand what is going on over there. And the feedback I received, as I say, discussing with the market and also StoneX Meats and Livestock team in Kansas City, at the minute there is no signs, genuine signs of a rebuild. Seasonally, from a seasonal perspective, if you sort of cut the US in half, the western half of the country where there's good numbers of cows, like good numbers of breeding cattle are in that sort of western half of the country into the Rockies, Colorado, Utah, etc., it's still experiencing quite challenging conditions. And you could say drought conditions, potentially worse than if you were to compare it to 12 months ago. So that isn't supporting a rebuild at the minute. There's also some land use changes, expansion of metropolitan areas, the aging demographic of producers. So when we combine all those factors, basically the news and the feedback is that I received when asked about the rebuild, it is still a way off yet. It's not in a position at the minute to be occurring, and there are still some headwinds that market needs to sort of address or face before a rebuild can genuinely take place. So the hope from the market ultimately is really stabilisation, and they want to see stabilisation in the numbers before genuine rebuilding can commence.
So hence the US is after beef, and it's getting ready to lift a year-long ban on Mexican cattle imports as of next week. What's your understanding on the rollout of that and what it might mean?
Yeah, first time in a long time that they'll look to begin re-importing Mexican cattle. It's the understanding and the information I received from my time over there, it's going to be a very staged and staggered approach. So there's a port opening in Arizona as of next Monday, the 24th of August. We'll be the first one to reopen to begin to see numbers start flowing back into that market. There's a little bit of sort of tentative unsurety, really, about how that's going to look. And a lot of that has to do with really just the unknown. You know, does it remain open consistently and you continue to start to see volumes rebuild in terms of imports out of Mexico? The other question that the market has at the minute, over the last 18 months to 2 years, is that Mexico itself and its beef industry has invested and expanded its own domestic capacity and capability. That's feedlot space and obviously processing space as well. So there's a little question hanging over that relationship with the US at the minute is, do the numbers, you know, really get back to what they were prior to the border closing, or do those cattle which were traditionally sold as feeders actually remain in the Mexican domestic system and be fed and processed in the Mexican market and potentially end up in the US in a box rather than as feeder cattle? So there's a few unanswered questions there that the market wants to see play out.
The ban came in because of concerns around New World screwworm. What's happening in that space at the moment? Because it got into America.
It has, yeah, and it is in America at the minute. The conversations I had, it was acknowledged that biological and biosecurity threat, but it wasn't something that consistently came up in conversation, the screw worm itself. The more discussion I had with the market and people over there, close close to it was really about that supply, that critical supply coming out of Mexico rather than the screwworm itself. But I think, I suppose to surmise, they're going to have to deal with it and hopefully address to eradicate it where possible in those southern states, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, so it doesn't get any further into the sort of core breeding regions and cattle regions of the US.
If you're tuning in, this is The Country Hour, and we're speaking to Ripley Atkinson from StoneX, who's just spent the last couple of weeks in the United States. How are processors, meat processors, going in America at the moment?
They're struggling, Matt, and have been for some time. Losses in US dollar terms anywhere from $200 to sort of $500 a head. Late last week, Tyson Foods announced a closure of another processing plant in Illinois in the country's north. And then, you know, that they're ultimately losing capacity in that system. But the potential there, which they announced alongside the closure of the Illinois plant, was to bring on a second shift at Amarillo, which is in the state of Texas, which is in close proximity to large cattle supply. So some of the reasoning for that closure and bringing on of the second shift for Tyson plants was really to do with geographical proximity to cattle supply. I think more broadly, the processors are struggling. There is a belief from the market that these announcements of closures will continue simply because of the economics and the difficulty at the minute that processors are having in terms of being financially viable. And ultimately the question becomes, is there too much capacity at a processing level in the US, and how long will that last before more announcements are made with plants closing down, and ultimately that means a reduction in capacity to reflect reduced cattle supply.
So is it easy to summarise what all of this, we've covered a few topics here today, what does all of this mean for the Australian cattle industry?
I think the first thing to acknowledge is the US demand at a consumer level across both food service and retail remains very strong. And I think that's ultimately what we're looking to understand here for the Australian beef industry, is where does that demand sit? And fundamentally, the news I got from across the board was demand remains very sound. And I think that's what we want to understand first and foremost. From a rebuild perspective and the long-term structural situation the US is presented with its herd, you know, it looks likely that they're going to face some serious challenges long-term for numbers to really rebuild or grow. But when you look at the US herd and the trend of cattle numbers over the last 60 years, it's only been heading one way, and that's been down. So what does that mean from an Australian perspective? Imports are increasingly becoming a key role, and that's obviously coupled with the fact that demand remains solid. Australia is in a good position at the minute to support the US consumer base and the marketplace with beef we produce.
And Aussie beef that might have been going into China but is not doing that now because of a high tariff, is the US a vacuum cleaner for that type of beef?
Look, it's only early days considering the China quota was hit in June and South Korea in July. What I would say is we've seen a little bit of repositioning from Australian exporters into other markets. US volumes have remained stable, and ultimately what we saw was a bit of an uptick in other places across Asia. Canada, for example, has been an exceptional performer so far year-to-date in 2026, taking a lot of our products. So exporters are repositioning and diversifying where they send that beef. I think it's too early to tell if we're going to say a lot of it has been redirected into the US market. It's just we need a little more time to solidify where the volume is heading in there, but certainly exporters are finding homes for other or into other markets for that beef that was destined for China or South Korea.
Thanks so much for your time on The Country Hour today, Ripley. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
That is Ripley Atkinson, who is the Australian Manager for Meat and Livestock with StoneX. We've got to go to the newsroom, folks, because it's 1 o'clock. Plenty of text messages coming through about water, data centres, pests and diseases, so I'll get to that straight away. We'll go through some of these texts with you and then have a chat to the Weather Bureau about the week ahead. What was I looking at earlier? 9 millimetres in the gauge at the Alice Springs Desert Park this morning. There's been a little bit of rain about, hey? We'll learn more soon. Stick around.
Yeah, Gary Riggs, Lakefield Station. Just changed the bore pump, motor, and yeah, you listen to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. I trust you are well. Before 1:30, I hope you can stick around because we're going to meet some of the people that are keeping the art of stock whip making alive.
I think it's more important than ever because it builds character, it builds patience and unreal craft. Like, you know, if these kids are building a whip, they've got something to show for all their time and effort, and I think that's important.
And we've been talking about water on the Country Hour today. If you missed our top story, it's that Consolidated Pastoral Company, CPC, has been granted 4 water extraction licences in the territory. When you add them all up, they total more than 15,500 megalitres per year. So the 4 water licences are for cropping plans on Power Creek Station, Newcastle Waters and Tenandidgee in the Barkly region, and also for Dungowan Station, which is on the Buchanan Highway in the Victoria River District. We had a chat to the Chief Executive, Troy Setter, at the start of today's program. If you missed that conversation, it'll be up on our podcast later on. Our text number is 0487 991057. Alice says, Matt, the conversation about water usage for data centres, it's got me a little bit scared. Last October in Herbert, in Darwin's rural area, our bore got so low that it messed up my water pump and cost me about $500 to fix, says Alice out in Herbert. A few more questions about the size of the water allocation there for Consolidated Pastoral Company. I've got my calculator out and I'm trying to do my best for you. I've got all the stats on the Georgina Basin, which is where the big licences for Newcastle Waters and Tenandidgee, they'll be extracting from the Georgina Basin, right? So if you add them up, it's a bit over 10,000 megs a year, which I've got is the equivalent of 4,140 swimming pools. It's also 0.0015% of the total storage of that aquifer. So that's the equivalent of taking 37 litres out of an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Picture yourself at a pool, you maybe got a 2-litre milk carton. Fill that up less than 20 times. That's what's happening in the Barkly with these licences. I hope that helps. I hope that paints a picture for you. If you've got more questions, send them through and we'll do our best here at the Country Hour. Let's go to the Weather Bureau now. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. And Sally, there's been a little bit of rain around in the centre.
Oh, yes, there certainly has. And most of it's fallen to around that Alice Springs, the eastern end of the Western McDonald's. So Hermannsburg got 8 millimetres, but across the catchment for the Todd, there's a lot of 10 millimetres. Collier Creek got 17 millimetres. Andulia, 10. The Hugh River got 10 millimetres as well. Fink got 7. Schwartz Crescent got 9. So there's rain in town as well. The Wildlife Park got 9, or the Desert Park got 9 mils, and Big Dipper 9 as well. The Wrigley Gorge 11. So, yeah, widespread falls around that area of around about that 10-millimetre mark.
Is there more to come?
Yes. We've got a bit of a cloud band developing. There's still the odd shower, and we had some storms up in the southern Barkly this morning. Bit of rain tomorrow. We've got these sort of troughs going through. We keep on creating little cloud bands, and so there's the chance we'll see rain. They sort of wax and wane a little bit, so Thursday might be a bit of a lull, and then we've got another band developing or moving north, so we might see some storms in there, and then hangs around Saturday, and then sort of clear Sunday, but another one comes in from the west. and moves across on Monday. So, yeah, we're not going to see any clearance probably until at least mid to late next week.
Right. So in this sort of next system, potentially how many millimetres for certain parts?
You could see those 10-millimetre rainfalls again. Some of the models are higher, of course, some are lower. Some have it in a totally different location. So it's really okay to watch this space, but just be aware that we could see some. We will continue to see the rain around, and just be careful what it does actually does if you're moving around a bit.
What a year it's turning out to be for Central Australia.
Just as
things are drying out. Little top up.
Yeah, and the temperatures have been pretty close to average for what we'd expect to see. Some of those two degrees and under, they're pretty close to about what we're on track for where we are at this time. Top end, not quite so much. We've had a sort of fewer nights below 20. We're a bit over halfway where we should be for this time of year, but Central Australia's been reading the climate stats.
Wow. What about the top end for the week ahead? What's to report?
Fogs. If eastern top end and Carpentaria district fogs. We might even see the odd sea fog. We had a good one yesterday. Not so much today, but that's just something to be aware of if you're heading out around the southern Gulf Carpentaria. The showers around the northeast coast and then popping up in the morning on the west coast as the little waves come across. And just to the how far they get into the top end will vary a little bit, but we should see those showers about the northeast, at least the northeast coast, for the next week anyway.
Okay, and what about the coastal waters this week for our fishing friends?
Oh, it's a little bit windy out there. If you're on the west coast, so we're looking 10 to 15 knots, and that's even right through to Wednesday. We're still seeing those easterly winds 10 to 15 knots. Along the north coast, 15 to 20, so it's a little bit breezy out there. That extends into the Gove Peninsula coastal areas and around the Cape Arnhem down to the Queensland border. We're looking 10 to 15 today, reaching up to 20 knots north of Numbawa during the day. It's north of Groote Eylandt tomorrow, those winds reaching up to 20 knots. And still looking at sort of 15 to 20 knots during the morning on Wednesday across the area. Yep. So it's going to be a little bit breezy out there.
Okay. And is just a little bit of humidity starting to creep into the story in the top end?
Yeah, a little bit. We've gone fairly easterly, but it looks like we might get a burst of dry air coming through. And the wind's picking up as a little bit of an easterly surge comes through midweek. So just keep an eye on the fire dangers with respect to that.
Beauty. Anything else that you think we should be aware of?
No, that's really it. The getting warmer in the south underneath all this cloud band with the northerly winds, and in the north we're just continuing more of the same.
Right. With the cricket done and dusted now in Darwin, I've missed out on an opportunity. I had a person on the weekend saying, Matt, ask the Bureau about the Fenny Bay Doctor and how it's looking for Monday afternoon. But I assume you know the reference there, you know?
The reference to the Fremantle Doctor.
Yeah, yeah, we've got the Fenny Bay Doctor, which was blowing fairly decently there on,
yeah.
When did I go to the cricket? Saturday. Yeah, yeah, the flags were flying, the Fenny Bay Doctor was in. Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah. Well, we're getting 35 degrees inland, so and the seas haven't been heated up yet for coming out of the cooler months, so we've got that good temperature gradient across the land-sea boundary. So we are, decent sea breezes at this time of year.
Have a lovely afternoon, Sally. Thanks for your time.
Will do, thanks. Bye.
Sally Cutter there at the Weather Bureau. Our text number is 0487991057. Someone has sent a beautiful picture and says, was good to see this on my rounds this morning. It's a beautiful picture, someone on horseback on, well, it looks like the highway. Might be the Stuart Highway. There's some lovely cattle crossing the road, and my eyes can't quite tell the sign as to, it's definitely a CPC station. Producer Tom, are your eyes better than mine? I just can't quite tell what station this is, but a lovely photo. Blue skies, good-looking cattle crossing the highway. But obviously enough people around to make it all safe and sound. So thank you for sending that through. Another text to the Country Hour this afternoon, and this is in reference to our earlier conversation about New World screwworm in South America and how the US is getting ready to open up the gates again to Mexican cattle imports. Someone here says, it seems to me that no matter what pest or disease globally, it eventually gets here. You've only got to look at our history in the last 10 years. Yes, unfortunately, there's been a few biosecurity problems in the NT over recent times, but perhaps some really cool work happening at Charles Darwin University could help us. I'll share this story with you next.
In the September issue of Gardening Australia, you'll find long-lasting flowers, native gardens, tropical plants, help with roses, and tips on growing spring veg. Gardening Australia from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
Yeah, if you've ever struggled to diagnose what's impacting the health of your crops, or maybe just problems in the backyard veggie patch, well, researchers at Charles Darwin University might soon have a solution. In collaboration with Sri Lankan academics, the team at CDU have successfully trained artificial intelligence to recognise plant diseases by creating a database of 9,000 images of sick tomato plants. It's all starting with tomatoes, but hopefully we'll expand. Dr. Tusitan Selvaraja told Sam Parry that this system has been designed with territory farmers in mind.
We don't have a kind of consistent internet in the Northern Territory farms. Therefore, we didn't want to basically deploy this in a data center. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we thought is we develop the models directly on the devices of the farmers. So the workflow is very simple. So the initial idea is to deploy the model directly on the mobile phones. So what the farmer has to do is they have to just basically go to the farm, and then they just have to take a photo of the leaf, and then they have to upload it to the mobile app. Then it will show what kind of disease that particular leaf has. We started with 890 real field photographs that are collected in fields from Sri Lanka.
So these were all tomato plants in Sri Lanka with various diseases or ailments?
That's correct, yeah. So we have collected the tomato disease samples from different locations. So Sri Lanka has three different kinds of weather conditions. So we collected data from all three of them.
So this is about being able to create a system of AI disease detection that works in the real world. Why might we want to have AI detect diseases rather than just a human go out and look at it with their own eyes?
Basically, the AI learns from thousands of examples of healthy and diseased leaves. It is better in learning visual patterns, such as changes in color, texture, shape. Yeah, I wouldn't say that AI is simply better than the human eye. Agricultural experts may have better knowledge than an AI systems can have, but AI has a different advantage. Basically, it can continuously analyze a very large number of images without getting tired or distracted.
Yeah,
and also it can detect patterns that may be difficult for a person to notice consistently. So I see AI as a tool to support farmers and agricultural experts rather than replacing them. That's the very big fear at the moment, right? So,
what are the end use cases of this research?
So what we thought is we develop a model that can be deployed directly on their mobile devices. So that was the initial plan. But it could be extended to drones or fixed cameras, and it could monitor much larger areas with even the robotic technology.
Where could this be applied in the Northern Territory, do you think? What kind of crops might it be useful to monitor?
So at the moment, we just worked with tomato plant only. It's just an example of where this technology could be applied. The same general approach could be developed for crops such as mangoes and cotton, which are much more relevant to agriculture in Northern Territory. But we can't simply take a tomato model and expect it to diagnose diseases in mangoes and cotton. We would need to collect representative field samples for those crops. But as I mentioned earlier, we need to basically have some sample images for each of those images in order to make it workable or make it generalized for other plant types as well.
That is Dr. Tusitan Selvaraja from Charles Darwin University talking AI diagnosis with Sam Parry. It's 20 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, we're going to meet some of the people involved in keeping the art form alive of making stock whips in Australia. But first, let's have a tune. I went to the official opening of a steakhouse in Darwin on Friday night. It was a big shindig. It's a restaurant that is serving Territory beef, which is kind of cool. And Tom Curtin performed live there on Friday night. For me, this was the song of the night. Let's crack a whip next, eh? Here's to you, Tommy Curtin from Catherine. The Country Hour will be broadcasting from K-Town tomorrow if all goes to plan. Now, here is a sound that has echoed across Australian cattle country for generations. But stock whips, they take a lot of work to make, and it's getting harder to find people who know how to actually do this. Well, a man who learned his craft under R.M. Williams himself is determined to keep this craft alive and is travelling around Australia to teach the next generation, as Amy Mitchell reports.
But I think I've nearly, you know, watched it.
The conversations ebb and flow at the Bloomsbury Soldiers Memorial Hall.
Yeah, I'm having trouble getting around this corner. Can I chop it off?
Yeah.
A group of women have traded the hustle and bustle of family and farm for an artisan's workshop, where sharp knives, leather gauges, and the sheets of finely cut kangaroo skin are the focus, as they learn to make one of Australia's most iconic bush tools, the stock whip.
We talk about the tools and the leather and how to select skins, and then I show them how to cut out, and then they're all cutting out their own because that's the only way they'll learn. And then we start to put them together, as you can see. Jane over here, she's already plaiting. Some of the others they've plaited, so we'll just keep them going and hopefully we'll get finished by tomorrow night.
Standing among them is master leather plaiter Bill Webb.
Well, you really, all you need is a sharp knife, and I've got some special gauges here made out of dolly pegs, and they're all interchangeable. And we do have some special tools, like this is a whip cutter. If you can see, the fence is movable, so you can adjust the width on it. Then we have what we call a lace cutter and something we call a fid for poking through, you know, back plaiting leather or poking through making knots. And that's about all there is in a really sharp knife.
He is regarded as one of the country's finest craftsmen. His work has travelled to Brazil, England, Italy and the United States. He has won multiple Dame Mary Durack Awards, which for Bill are regarded as the Melbourne Cup of the plaiting world. But ask him what he's most proudest of, he talks about teaching.
You know, my sort of, I don't know what your aim or mission in life is, to try and keep the art form of leather plaiting alive. And that was RM's dream, that someone would keep it alive.
Long before Bill became the teacher, he was simply Boy. It was the nickname given to him by legendary bushman Reginald Murray Williams, famously known today as RM Williams. The pair first met when Bill was a teenager, spending school holidays mustering on neighbouring properties. His payment wasn't money. It was 2 weeks learning beside the man whose name would become synonymous with Australian bush culture.
He was such a generous man. If you were fair dinkum, he'd give you the shirt off his back.
RM also demanded perfection. A piece that looked finished to everyone else often wasn't finished to him.
He'd look at it and say, you can do better than that, start again.
More than half a century later, Bill still hears RM's words every time he starts a new piece.
he's just always saying, you know, try and make the next one better than the last one and be the best that you can be.
Around the Bloomsbury Hall, the ladies are starting to understand why. Making a whip involves focus and steady movements to perfect not just what is seen on the outside, but also to establish the foundations and finally the finishings on the inside too. Bill believes 70% of the job happens before the first strand is ever plaited.
It's all preparation. You've got to, you know, you've got to cut your strands evenly, get them and stretch them all and trim them all and bevel them all to make them so they all sit in nice and snug together. If you get your preparation right and get it carefully done, then everything will usually fall into place.
The workshop uses kangaroo leather, a material Bill has spent his lifetime championing.
Because kangaroo is the best, strongest leather in the world, inch for inch, pound for pound.
Workshop organiser Kimberly Kerry was raised on a large cattle property near Claremont in central Queensland. She grew up surrounded by horses, dogs and stock whips.
If we don't keep any of these old skills alive, they're going to be gone. With this age of digital technology and faces in screens, I think it's more important than ever because it builds character, it builds patience and unreal craft. Like, you know, if these kids are building a whip, they've got something to show for all their time and effort, and I think that's important.
By the final afternoon, every student has a finished whip.
It's pretty awesome. It is amazing. To have a finished product like this just pretty much is a testament to how great a teacher and just a gentleman he was. So much involved. I didn't realise how much was involved in building one. And once we worked out that first day, I'm like, rightio, we know what's going to follow.
The finished whip will take pride of place in Kimberly's home. It is her first, but she isn't planning for it to be her last. She's brought leather and tools from Bill so she can try making another whip on her own.
Because I loved old things, old handmade things, and it's good to keep that kind of thing alive, yes.
And there are already signs the lesson is spreading.
The boys are learning to crack their whips, and there may be a few marks because they learn. And learning how to do them is a craft that I would not like to be lost.
That is Kimberly Carey making stock whips and speaking to the Country Hour's Amy Mitchell. That wraps up today's program. If you've missed any of it, and we've done a fair bit today, it's all up on the podcast later on this afternoon. Keep it rural.